Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the second and final day of this ASEF meeting. May I kindly ask you to mute when you are not speaking? And we are going to start our discussions this morning with rate-regulated activities, and I give the floor to Mariëlle to introduce the topic for us.
Thank you very much, Hans. We're gonna be sharing the slides with you. So just a second. When they appear, I'll start. Perfect. Thank you. So, well, thank you very much, all of you, for attending this session. My name is Mariëlle Hesern, and I'm accompanied today by my colleagues, Rachel Nubli, Raghava Tirumala, and Xisheng Wang. During this comment period, we have been in touch with many of you for undertaking outreach events on the exposure draft, and we wanted, first of all, to say thank you to you and to your staff for all your help in the coordination of these events. You've been a powerful gate for us to reach out to many stakeholders, so thank you very much. The objective of this meeting is to gather your input on the main aspects of the proposals in the exposure draft, regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities that the board published in January this year. The ED is generally welcome. The proposals are expected to result in improved comparability among rate-regulated entities, which should be beneficial for users. A couple of additional and relevant effects of a future standard on regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities that a few stakeholders are already expecting to arise with the final standard are the following. The final standard is expected to require accounting and pricing teams to work much more closely, as the accounting teams will need to understand better from the pricing teams the basis for setting the rate to identify differences in timing and the reversals. And this should result in an enhancement of the financial reporting process, which should ultimately translate in useful information. And an additional positive effect that a stakeholder also shared with us, in this case, for the market, is that a future standard on regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities is expected to require greater clarity and precision in the basis for setting the rate, in the design of the rate by the authorities. And there is an expectation then that regulatory agreements and the rate-setting process would have to be enhanced when they are currently not that precise. So the standard could have an effect on the clarity of the regulatory agreement and the rate-setting processes. Stakeholders have also raised concerns on specific aspects of the model, and the structure of these slides cover the aspects of the ED for which we have received most of the feedback so far. So this is the scope, total allowed compensation, and measurement. We have not received detailed feedback on the interaction of the proposals with IFRIC 12 so far, and hence our question for your input in slide 22 of this deck. We wanted also to let you know that if any of you have views or feedback on other aspects of the model that we are not touching today, we would like to offer you the possibility to discuss those other items with us separately. So please feel free to contact us directly for that. So starting with the problem definition, so slides 5 to 6 provide background information on the proposals. They tackle what is the problem that the board is trying to solve and what is the proposed solution. And I'll go through them very briefly because you are already familiar with these proposals. So you know that entities affected by the proposals would be entities subject to rate regulation that establishes how much compensation entities can charge for goods and services and when these entities can include that compensation in the rates charged. Under this type of rate regulation, the regulated rate for goods and services supplied to customers in one period might include an amount that is, in fact, compensation for goods and services that were supplied in previous period, or compensation for goods and services that will be supplied in a future period. And when this happens, a difference in timing arises. So in other words, the period when a company supplies goods and services differs from the period when the compensation for those goods and services, is included in the rates charge and therefore is recognized in revenue. So when differences in timing occur, the amount of revenue an entity recognizes in a period, applying IFRS 15, includes compensation for goods or services supplied in the past or that will be supplied in the future, or does not include all the compensation that the entity is entitled for the goods or services supplied in the period, because part of this compensation was already included in the rates charged in the past or will be included in rates to be charged in the future. So this means that when there are differences in timing, the IFRS financial statements do not provide users with sufficient information for them to understand what part of the fluctuations in the revenue expense relationship is due to differences in timing. So basically, when there are differences in timing, IFRS financial statements do not provide users with sufficient information for them to understand fully an entity's financial performance. And as you know as well, so differences in timing represent rights to increase or obligations to decrease the rates in the future. And those rights and obligations are currently not recognized in the financial statements. And therefore, the information arising from the statement of financial position is also incomplete. So moving then to slide six, then, because of all these, the exposure draft proposes to require entities to provide information that enables users to understand the effects of differences in timing by recognizing regulatory assets, regulatory liabilities, regulatory income, and regulatory expense. And by doing this, by accounting for the effects of the differences in timing, an entity will be reflecting the compensation to which it is entitled for goods or services supplied as part of its reported financial performance for the period in which those goods or services are supplied. And this is precisely the underlying principle of the proposals in the exposure draft, which is shown in the bottom, in the box at the bottom of this slide. The ED calls this compensation total allowed compensation, and defines this at the full amount of compensation for goods or services supplied that a regulatory agreement entitles a company to charge customers through the regulated rates in either the period when the company supplies those goods or services or a different period. And we're going to start now then moving to the first of the aspects of the exposure draft for which we would like your feedback. And this is the scope. The scope of the ED is targeted to the accounting for regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, which is only a subset of rights and obligations created by a regulatory agreement. This means that the proposals would not apply to any other rights or obligations created by the regulatory agreement. To be within the scope of the ED, regulatory agreements need to be enforceable and determine the regulated rates to be charged to customers in a way that gives rise to differences in timing. This means the rate charge in a period includes compensation for goods or services that were supplied in a previous period or that will be supplied in a future period. If any of those conditions are not met, the proposals in the ED would not lead to an entity recognizing regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities. And understanding the design of the rate, its components, why they arise and how they reverse is key in the assessment of whether a specific basis for setting the rate causes differences in timing to arise, and therefore is key to assess whether an entity would be affected by the proposals. So we can move to the questions we have for you on the scope in slide nine, and I would then leave the floor to you. Thank you very much. The questions we have for you is whether you agree on the proposed scope, whether the proposals are clear enough, and whether you foresee assessing whether rights and obligations are enforceable would be challenging. So these are the questions we have for you on this scope.
Vincent? Yeah, sorry, I was on mute. Vincent, please.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning to everybody. So as a preliminary word, I want to thank you, Mariela, for the presentation. And I wanted to say that in France, in our jurisdiction, at least most of those who would be affected by the BOP proposal are pretty supportive of the BOP proposal and are looking forward to applying them, because this has been a quite long-standing project that is set to address what many see as a gap in the reporting of some entities' financial performance, and accordingly, this project is much more than welcome. And I think that our letter will be clearly supportive of the ED, but of course we have some reservation or would seek some clarification about some aspect of the ED. That being said, I will move to the question that we're asking to us about the scope. For question one, I would say that we are cautiously supportive of the proposed scope. We are supportive of the scope because, yes, from a very technical perspective, I think it's quite hard to call into question the scope that you have in the ED. And it is, I think, quite consistent with the approach that has been retained over the past year in terms of standard setting approach, focusing on the right and obligation that are in a contract or in agreement, rather than focusing on the features of those who are entering those contracts or focusing on the activities that are supported by those contracts. So from a technical perspective, we have no major issue with the criteria that you have set up. Having said that, we are cautiously supportive of that scope for two reasons. The first one is that I think that the scope is potentially wider than expected when the board started to work on this project more than 10 years ago. So there has been over time a shift from a focus from defined rate regulations to / rate regulated activities to some contracts that have specific features. So we think that at the end of the day, the scoping that you had, for instance, in the 2014 discussion paper, and the scope that you will have applying those proposals will ultimately overlap. But the problem is that at the moment, we still have some entities that may not have followed the latest development on this project and still think that this ED will only apply to utilities and to utility in the utilities sector, etc. And we are not sure, even though we try to do our best to raise some awareness about the project, that those entities will have thoroughly assessed whether they are in scope. So we still have some question mark and still don't know whether there are other entities that might be unintentionally captured in this ED. And the second reason why we are cautiously supportive of the scope is that basically, technically speaking, the scope does not limit the recognition of assets and liabilities to operations that are subject to little demand risk. And I think that because basically what we are doing in this project is that we are recognizing some specific type of contingent consideration, purchase aids, basically on the balance sheet. And we know that usually, and in particular, users of financial statement are pretty comfortable with that if that applies to assets to assets that are subject to little customer churn, etc. So technically, and this is why some of the stakeholders tended to have some sympathy for the alternative view that is in the ED and that asks whether you have enough in terms of scoping criteria to ensure that you're recognizing assets that are sufficiently different from any right to increase your future rates. So basically, you are not limiting the scope to the low risk to operations that are subject to low demand risk. But having said that, after having reached out to stakeholders, we have the feeling that basically the ED will capture entities who are subject to little, if any, demand risk. So that's why at the end of the process, we think that you are landing on the right place. But as I said earlier, we don't know whether all entities did the job properly of analyzing the proposal, and it's quite difficult to say to have a clear answer in that respect. So that's with regard to question two. I think that there are two aspects that, in our view, are quite important to be clarified in any final IFRS standards. I think the first one, I think that you have been made aware of that, is that there are still differing views about whether you formally need a regulator to recognize regulatory assets and liabilities. We think this is not the case. However, we think that some parts in the EDR are pretty ambiguous in that respect, and I think that would be very, very helpful. And it is also an essential point for some of the stakeholders to know whether you need the presence of any regulator. The second matter that should warrant further clarification is the fact that maybe the ED should state more clearly the fact that basically you have regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities will lead to adjustment to revenues with contract with customers in the scope of IFRS 15, because I think that it permeates all your proposal, but that would be financial institution in our countries may have rights and obligations that are similar to those that are described in the ED. However, at the end of the day, they will recognize interest revenue as specified in IFRS 9. And they conclude, and I think that they validly conclude, that they are not in the scope of this project, but I think that we have to make sure that you tie those proposals clearly with IFRS 15. And now with regard to question 3 about enforceable rights and obligation, I think that first it's quite important to remind that you are not creating something new in relation to enforceable rights and obligation, because this is basically you replicated what you already have in IFRS 15. And basically when we transitioned to IFRS 15 some years ago, basically we have to deal with that notion of enforceable rights and obligation. Having said that, we have to know that in this very specific case, that might be challenging to assess that notion in this very specific context, because the scope is designed in such a way that you will end up by capturing a wide spectrum of regulatory agreement with very differing maturity level. On the one hand, you can have rate adjustment mechanisms that will predetermine everything in terms of the regulated rate, so there will be absolutely almost no uncertainty about whether that kind of expense is allowable and for which amount and the amount that you can recover. But on the other hand, you might have some circumstances in which the regulation specifies that you have the right to recover the allowable sum expense plus a regulatory return, and the amount of expenses, the nature of the expenses will be subject to further discussion with the regulator. And this will be, there will be an overall negotiation with the regulator. And this is typically the case in cost of service mechanism. And in those circumstances, we have some stakeholders who really question whether the entity has an enforceable right and obligation, if the regulator can say, no, I'm not allowing you to recover that expense. While on the other hand, we have stakeholders, and I think that they are right, who say, well, basically, the right exists, it's just that there is some uncertainty about whether it exists, it is more likely or not that it exists, and accordingly, this matter should be dealt with in the context of the recognition requirement. But given the uncertainty that exists in this respect, I think that we will ask you to provide further guidance in this respect, in particular, what happens when you have a rate case or a negotiation process that happens with the regulator. And that's all on my side for this question.
Thank you, Vincent. Pauline?
Thank you. I should start, I think, by saying that as yet our outreach has been focused on those entities that we're already expecting to be within the scope of this paper, and also to users who follow those entities. And the feedback we're getting from those is very positive. They've been expecting this for a long time, and as Vincent says, this addresses a number of the issues that they've been concerned with. And I'm slightly concerned that what we're not being able to reach at the moment is those people who may be within the scope, but haven't yet realised that that's the case. And I think that our concerns are primarily based around the clarity of the change in scope since the discussion paper. So I listen with interest to Vincent's comments, because I think there are some similar issues arising in the UK. But until we actually can identify those people who are within the scope, it's actually quite challenging to determine whether the proposals are actually going to work for them as well. I certainly understand why the scope is as it is, but I think it probably needs some further clarity to make sure that companies have the right information to determine whether or not they're within the scope. And part of that may be perhaps giving an example of where the scope is not, a regulatory agreement is outside the scope. For example, if you've got a simple price cap which isn't linked to the services, the timing of the services that are being performed. So at this stage, I think we have a very positive view of the proposals, but we think that the scope for proposals need to be just explored a bit further so that we've got complete clarity over the entities that are being affected by it. And the next stage of our outreach will certainly be looking at where we think other entities might be caught, so we can actually go and talk more directly to them about the implications of the standard. Thank you.
Thank you, Pauline. Linda?
Thank you, Hans. I want to emphasize that we've had a lot of outreach here in Canada. Should come as no surprise since we're very interested in this project and very supportive of this project. I want to also publicly thank Mariella and the whole staff team. They have been engaged in, I think, the very vast majority of our outreach and done an excellent job of interacting with our stakeholders in terms of explaining things and having an excellent dialogue. So overall, and the other thing I want to emphasize is our board is still deliberating, so the views I'm expressing are based on our early deliberations, and we will be looking at another draft of our comment letter at our July meeting. Overall, we're supportive of the proposed scope criteria, but based on concerns we had heard from other jurisdictions, we have done everything we can to identify but have not yet found situations in which the proposals would affect activities that should not be within the scope of the ED. We think the scope is generally clear, similar to what others have said, to entities that are in the utilities industry and have followed this project all along. But there still seems to be some uncertainty or questions raised, and we think this is driven by the fact that there's entities that are still trying to understand whether the form of regulation they are subject to is within the scope. And like any new standard, certain entities who may not have been involved in this project all along may need to just assess if at the margin this new guidance is relevant to them. So we're just going to suggest at this stage, and we're still debating, whether it might be helpful to add some scope exclusions to clarify and save time and effort in terms of making it very clear what's within the scope. And so just some suggestions that we are still discussing would be things like stating that regulatory agreements that give rise to financial assets and financial liabilities are not within the scope of the standard. We've also heard some general concerns about how some insurance rates in our country are set based on the costs of providing service. And while we've not been able to confirm that the concerns raised result in differences in timing yet that would give rise to regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, we think that the model is intended to supplement the information an entity provides by applying IFRS 15 as opposed to 17. So we don't think revenue resulting from rates applied to insurance contracts with customers would fit. But to ease concerns, we could also suggest a scope exclusion if they're applying IFRS 17. So initially, those are our thoughts. And in terms of the definition of the regulatory agreement, we think you could also reinforce the notion that the regulatory agreement establishes an entity's total allowed compensation and determines when to include the compensation in the regulatory rate to be applied on contracts with customers. So some things that may likely appear in our comment letter with regard to clarification of what you're already proposing as scope. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Jay Ho.
Thank you, Hans. We generally agree with the proposed scope, and In addition, we hope an illustrative example could be incorporated in the final standard about a situation in which the regulatory agreement involves the regulator's approval process. There is the situation where the regulator can defer approving a rate increase indefinitely. This might happen especially when the regulator is trying to minimize the negative impact of a rate increase on the price index in macroeconomic terms. So that is actually the case with a major state-owned utility company in our jurisdiction. So this has caused intense controversy for many years over whether the company's right to a rate increase in the future should be recognized as an asset in spite of the potential for the rate increase to be indefinitely deferred, or the company should be viewed as having no right, having no present right to a rate increase because the timing for rate increase is subject to high uncertainties. The state-owned utility company is currently developing an illustrative example applicable to them. So we expect that we could relay their example when we send our comment letter to the ISB in due course. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jeho. Raymond?
Thank you, Hans. Just to start off with, there's been very positive feedback received so far. We received very positive feedback on the paper. Like I said yesterday, I think this is something that's been a long time coming, certainly expected in our part of the world. And similar to what a lot of people have said already this morning, there are some concerns around the scoping and what entities are going to be scoped into this exposure doc, into the standard. Given where we've been in the past and what that scoping was, there was a limitation to that scoping, which seems to have been expanded upon in this next iteration, that is of concern. Part of the conversations that we've had at the moment is which industries are going to be affected by this, what arrangements are going to be covered by this. Does it mean that if we've got price-controlled products, that that's in the scope of this product? We appreciate that, you know, things that the usual suspects, electricity, fuel, people of that sort of ilk will be caught in the net. But there are some additional industries that maybe there might be maximum pricing mechanisms or might be internal price setting mechanisms that are in place. Would they be in the scope of the standard? In addition to that, the definition of a regulator does not seem to have been incorporated into what we've seen. And I think that may play an important part in just enabling people to understand what is in the scope and what is outside of the scope of the standard. With respect to the third question that has been asked here, part of what we see happens across the African continent at the moment is that when price setting mechanisms are put in place, there is a public consultation process that is also undertaken before a price is finally agreed on. Now, the problem with that is if this consultation process yields a result that is different to what was initially expected, that may then affect the measurement of the asset and an asset or liability, depending on what it is that needs to be reflected in the books. I guess I'm answering a question that will be asked later on, but already from a measurement process, there are some concerns that are starting to arise about, well, how would it be applied in practice? And I think some additional examples and that sort of thing may be useful in terms of just enabling people to understand how to apply this in practice. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Raymond. Vincent Papa.
Thank you, Hans. So from EFRAG's point of view, in our draft comment letter, which was issued in April, we acknowledge the merits of a broad definition of the scope. We also concur with the comments that's been made by others around the clarity on the scope for the utility sector. Nevertheless, as also has been pointed out by others, there's a question of clarity on the scope outside of the utility sector. So we've been exploring that in our outreach. So for example, if there are possible impacts for the banking and insurance entities, as I think has been pointed out by Linda, as well as any other sectors where there could be a natural monopoly, and there may be in place pricing structures that resemble those that occur within the utility sector. I guess another question, which probably will be dealt with when we get to the interaction with other IFRS standards, is a question of interaction with IFRIC 12 requirements, and we are undertaking some outreach as well to have some understanding as to where questions do arise vis-a-vis whether agreements or arrangements fall within the scope of the proposed standard as opposed to falling within the IFRIC 12 requirements. For purposes of clarity on scope, similar to Jay Ho, our draft comment letter proposes that there's a need for more specific guidance and examples on what constitutes a regulatory agreement. We also question and seek views on whether it would be helpful to describe the characteristics of a regulator so as to minimize instances where the lack of clarity on whether an entity is in scope or not. The final comment I'd make really is drawn from the June CFSS meeting that we had. And there are some members also indicated that there are scope questions which do arise from the nature of regulatory agreements within their jurisdictions. For example, there can be permanent differences between IFRS-based costs and a differing regulator-determined cost base. And there has been a question of the implications of such situations on scope eligibility. So for instance, a particular European jurisdiction highlighted that the recovered costs for their regional utility operators tend to be determined on an average basis. So there are really questions for those type of fact patterns. Do they fall within the scope or not? In sum, I would say that in addition to a comment letter where we sought constituents' views, we're also undertaking an effects analysis, and we hope this will also help to inform our views on scope, which we'll articulate in our final comment letter. Thank you.
Thank you, Vincent. You?
Okay. Thank you, Hans. Actually, we have been paying high attention to this project since the exposure draft was published at the end of January. We have translated the main body of the ED into Chinese and published it in China to seek feedback from the different stakeholders. At the same time, we conducted a lot of outreaches and interviews with the regulators and the regulated companies. We also have some roundtable meetings and have discussions with the preparers, auditors, regulators, and academics. The project team in China is now working on finalizing our final comment letter. According to the comments we have received so far, the Chinese stakeholders have some comments on the scope of the ED. Basically, the stakeholders expressed some concerns about the scope. They are afraid that this project will not applied. This project might not be applied in China because the most stakeholders think that the accounting model proposed in the ED is highly dependent on the regulatory agreements. And this kind of regulatory agreements would be will have clear terms and is enforceable to be executed. However, most of the regulatory model in China is framework oriented. For example, the regulated companies do not have the enforceable rights and obligation in the process of determining the regulated rates and the total allowed compensation. Therefore, in the stakeholders' view, they think it's very difficult to apply the proposed accounting model for the regulated companies in China. That's just the concerns and the comments from our stakeholders. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Yu. Takeshi, finally.
Thank you, Hans. We, AOSSG, have asked our members for comments on each question. In order to avoid the duplication, I'd like to convey the comments from jurisdictions other than China, Korea, and Japan. Regarding question one, two members consider that the proposed scope is appropriate. However, another member thinks that the ED should apply only to regulatory agreements that have a particular legal form or those enforced by a regulator with particular attributes. This member proposes that the ED should contain the definition and attributes of the regulator. Regarding question two, one member says that some stakeholders were unsure whether they'll be captured by the proposal since the scope is too broad. Regarding question three, well, one member notes that the assessing the enforceability is not challenging since the agreements are with the regulator and enforcement provisions are likely to be clearly set up in the regulatory agreements. That's it.
Thank you, Takeshi. Okay, Mariela, I think you can continue with the next topic.
Thank you very much. Yes, the next session is on total allowed compensation. So we can move then to slide 11. All right, so we referred to total allowed compensation before, and this slide outlines its components: allowable expenses, less chargeable income, target profit, and regulatory interest income or regulatory interest expense. And within target profit, the main components are regulatory returns and performance incentives. These components might be included in the rates in the same period as the supply of the related goods or services or in a different period. The exposure draft provides guidance to help an entity determine whether components of total allowed compensation included in the rates charged to customers in a period relate to goods or services supplied in the same period or to goods or services supplied in a different period. The next slide outlines when these components affect profit, that is the period in which that component would be reflected in the statement of financial performance. So in the interest of time, I would like to focus on the second component of total allowed compensation, which is target profit, and more specifically on regulatory returns on an asset that is not yet available for use because, for example, it is being constructed. So this is probably the most controversial aspect of the exposure draft, hence worth refreshing briefly the proposal. So if we move to slide 13, this slide and the next reflect two possible regulatory approaches for returns on construction work in progress. This slide illustrates the approach in which these returns are included in the rates charged to customers during periods when the asset is not yet available for use, for example, during the construction period of an asset. This is a regulatory approach frequently used in some jurisdictions in Europe. And in this case, then, the regulatory returns are included in revenue during the construction period. Applying the proposals, an entity would be required to account for a regulatory liability and corresponding regulatory expense during the construction period. And this means that the proposals do not view these returns as relating to compensation for goods or services supplied during the construction period, because during that period, the entity is not yet supplying goods or services with that asset. The proposals understand that these returns should be reflected in the operating period of the asset when the asset is depreciated and is used to supply goods or services. Supplying the proposals during the operating period, the entity would fulfill that regulatory liability as it supplies goods or services with the asset once this asset is in use, and by doing so would be reflecting these returns in profit during the operating period for that asset. The following slide illustrates the second approach that is used in regulatory agreements. And under this approach, the regulatory agreement gives an entity a right to accumulate regulatory returns for an asset being constructed that isn't yet available for use, and to include those accumulated returns in the rates to be charged to customers once the asset is available for use. So in this case, the returns are included in the rates when the asset is in operation. And this regulatory approach is commonly used in Canada and also in the States. So also in this case, the ED proposes that any returns on an asset under construction form part of the total allowed compensation for the goods and services supplied once the asset is available for use. So applying the proposals, these accumulated regulatory returns would form part of total allowed compensation during the operating phase of the asset. This would represent a change for those entities that by applying IFRS 14, for example, continue recognizing regulatory balances in accordance with their previous GAAP when that GAAP is US GAAP or a GAAP base or similar to US GAAP. Entities currently applying US GAAP would be typically capitalizing as a regulatory balance or as part of PP&E the amount of the returns that relate to the equity compensation. And they would capitalize those this compensation for equity costs as against either other income or less financial costs. And this is the only piece that the proposals would change, so the capitalization of the equity returns. However, we have learned that during the construction period, these amounts can be material and hence some concern from these stakeholders. According to the proposals then, all regulatory returns to which an entity is entitled for assets under construction would be reflected in profit as when those are added into the rates, that means during the operation of the asset. And we can then move to the questions we have for you on total allowed compensation.
Okay, I open the floor for questions 4 through 6. Alberto. Alberto, are you perhaps on mute?
Sorry.
I cannot. Oh, yes. There we go.
We have had outreach on this exposure draft. We also had some meetings with the companies which will be affected by this and their auditors. We have collected a number of comments which will be brought to our board next week in order to prepare a formal comment letter. On the subject of not recognizing return on asset under constructions, there is a majority view which is against your approach. The reason is that the construction period in many instances is very long and do not recognize these returns means that the company will show a loss because they will support the cost for building this asset for a long period of time. And these people view these returns on asset under construction as a way to match the finance cost that the companies must support during the construction period. On another subject, I mean, recognizing contract asset and the contract liabilities, the threshold is for both in your ED, more likely than not. Again, almost all the comments we received on this is that they will like a different threshold. And for the asset, they would like a highly probable type of, rather than more likely than not. Highly probable, why? It's based just on prudence. Prudence is in other standards, so why not on this one? I don't know if there is a specific question on the next item I want to touch on, but we are against the exception that applying IFRS 3 in a business combination, these assets and liabilities should not be measured at fair value. We don't believe that this exception is justified. It seems that this means justified mainly on complexity, but we don't see why measuring a fair value, a contract asset, or a contract liability is more complex than fair valuing an intangible asset like, you know, list of clients or things like that. And finally, I haven't talked about this scope which was discussed before, but there is quite a widespread perception that in applying this AD, and will be finalized, it will have to be applied, a lot of implementation issues will emerge on both the scope of what is the enforceability. There might be also quite unusual circumstances. For instance, we have been told that there is a case, or maybe more than a case, where part of this additional compensation is directly paid by a public entity. And so might be the case to reflect whether government grants would apply. So what we think is that a post-implementation review should start soon after the implementation of this standard. Thank you.
Thank you, Alberto. Linda.
Thank you, Hans. I appreciate the way Mariella has honed in on this issue, because other than this issue, in Canada, we have widespread support for the proposals relating to total allowed compensation. But on this issue, we've heard a lot of concern. So our stakeholders have told us, in particular, the users have been very uniform in telling us that the outcome of the proposal in their mind diminishes the relevance of the financial statements that would result. And they cite the following reasons, that the proposal, if applied the way it does not reflect the financial effects of the rate regulator's action to provide returns during the construction period. The rate regulator compensates the entity for the capital invested in constructing assets, and that's a regular process here. And reflecting regulatory returns earned during construction helps the users understand the regulatory environment. So in other words, they can see through the return that the regulator is supportive of the projects, the credit quality of the entity is supported by getting this return, and it allows them to better understand future cash flow projections during this period. And I'll reiterate what's already been said, is that some of these construction periods are quite long. Preparers have told us that this proposal results in operational complexity because they will have to make system changes needed to track this portion of regulatory returns separately for each asset being constructed during these periods. And so they're concerned about the additional operational complexity and cost. And in our jurisdiction, because we do have entities that use U.S. GAAP and will continue to use U.S. GAAP, Some will drop off because we have a temporary exemptive relief for certain entities, but we do have a few large entities that have always used U.S. GAAP. It affects comparability with U.S. GAAP, and we've had some long discussions on this within our board and staff, including sitting down and trying to do journal entries to actually show what would happen under current U.S. GAAP and what would happen under this proposal. And the notion that with all other circumstances, you get remarkably close to the same outcomes, and yet this one is a big difference in terms of comparability. So I want to emphasize that our board is still deliberating this feedback, but our overall observation is that there is a tension between the conceptual basis of the proposal, which we do support, and providing relevant information to users. We are exploring within our discussions if there are pragmatic solutions that we could recommend to you that we would be including in our comment letter, but we would also encourage you to see if there's a pragmatic way that could be identified to ensure that the outcome of the proposal would provide more relevant information to our users. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Gerson?
Yes, thank you. So with regard to question four, yes, we agree with the focus that is on TAC and the support for recognition of the regulatory assets and liabilities. Unsurprisingly, I would say with regard to question five, I think our constituents overall generally agree with the requirements and the application guidance on how to determine the TAC. However, on the regulatory returns on assets that are not yet available for use, there is quite a strong disagreement about that proposal. And I would say that the level of controversy that exists in this respect may not always be commensurate to the amount at stake, because we expect that the amount at the end of the day might not be so material for many entities, but however, for a few entities that the amounts at stake could be material. And so that's why the matter is worth being discussed further. I think that we can appreciate and understand from where the board is coming on this respect, but we are not really convinced by the... We think that the technical argument that were put on the table were not necessarily sufficiently compelling to require that accounting. The first, I will make very quick comment on the technical part of our comments. Well, not necessarily, first of all, I'm not really necessarily convinced by the explanation that are set out in the basis for conclusion on DED and about the willingness of the board to make the two types of regulatory agreements similar with that proposal. And in particular, we don't really understand what you say in paragraph BC 96 of DED. And we don't understand why you want to reach comparability, considering the fact that the underlying agreements are dissimilar in nature. In addition, we think that basically you have a quite restrictive view when you say that basically no goods or services are being supplied to the customer with that asset before it is available for use. Of course, strictly speaking, the asset is not providing goods and services to the customer. But at the same time, the entity is not doing anything. We think that it is part of the entity's obligation specified in the regulatory agreement to construct assets and to manage a portfolio of assets. And this is the overall portfolio of assets that that enable the entity to deliver the goods and services to the customer base as a whole. So that's why we think that there is a case that could justify recognizing, including those returns on the construction phase. And we also think that as Linda said earlier, some other people who commented before me just specifying basically, the regulator may also be compensating the entity for carrying the cost during the construction phase, and that should be reflected in profit or loss. And as a last technical comment, we also think that your proposal in this respect is not fully consistent with the requirement that you have specified for when to include performance incentive in the TAC. And my last comment on this point is that there is a technical disagreement, but there is also, as Linda said, there are also operational implications, and there is a clear agreement on the fact that basically this proposal would be very burdensome to apply. With regard to question six, I think that the only item for which we think that further guidance should be developed is maybe the site. We think that at the moment there is nothing in the ED that caters for the circumstances in which the expenses become allowable at the timing specified in the regulatory agreement, but that timing differs from when the expenses are recognized applying IFRS standards. In other words, there is nothing accommodating the circumstances between the regulatory agreement / IFRS discrepancies in terms of timing of expense. And we think that basically you could further develop some requirement to accommodate some circumstances because such discrepancies may exist. to a very limited extent, and this is in particular the case for pension expenses, and we think that we would invite you to investigate further. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Vincent. Jim?
Thank you, Hans. First, U.S. constituents, I think, are very encouraged by the proposal. While it differs in some respects from GAAP as applied in the U.S., it will draw much more closely the results and result in greater global consistency, particularly when looking at, I would say, total performance. The U.S. approach is a cost deferral approach and doesn't focus on regulatory income and expense, but rather focuses on the asset and the liability by deferring costs or accruing a liability. Our constituents have found that serves them well, but particularly serves their user well. Again, I think, as Linda said, when you look through it, in most cases, the results, particularly in total performance, will be very similar. This seems to be an area, at least when we talk initially to preparers here, of questions about the level of complexity vis-a-vis the level of benefit. They don't necessarily see that users will benefit and see, at least in GAAP as applied in the U.S., a simpler solution. Now, perhaps that's because that's where they start from. So just passing on the feedback we hear.
Thank you, Jim. Nobu?
Yes, thank you, Hans. Our preliminary view is that we are not convinced with adjusting revenue for all changes in regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. For example, when the regulated entity incurs huge losses due to a natural disaster and the regulatory framework allows the entity to recover such losses in future periods, preparers and users in our jurisdiction believe that the huge regulatory income figure that would be reported in the period the losses are incurred would not provide useful information. Rather, preparers and users think that an adjustment should be made to the expenses. We think this type of regulatory framework is similar to government grants, and we note that IS 20 currently permits grants related to income to be presented as income or a reduction of expenses. So to be consistent with that, we think there should be cases where the expenses would be adjusted. Thank you.
Thank you, Nobu. Vincent?
Thanks, Hans. In DFRAG's draft comment letter, we support the overall approach to determining total allowed compensation. But we did not have a position and expressed two views on the particular issues of construction work in progress regulatory returns, particularly when the asset is not in use. The first view was against the ED's proposals on grounds of cost-benefit analysis as well as operationality concerns, including the ability to tie goods and services supplied to a particular asset. We also noted a concern expressed about the deviation from the approach that's being taken within the regulatory agreement. The view two was in support of the ED's proposal, just based on consistency with the model principle that the total allowed compensation should be recognized when goods and services are supplied. There was also a concern expressed by a user in our technical expert group about what was considered to be front-loaded profitability and therefore shrunken margins when assets become operational. In our outreach, we've heard broadened arguments, and I would say they're both conceptual and revolve around the usefulness of information as well as elaborating on the operationality concerns that we expressed in our draft comment letter. And I would say the bulk of what we've heard, I think, has been captured by the comments that have been made by Linda, Vincent, as well as Albert. But just I'll reiterate that the various considerations would be important for IFRAG's technical expert group when we are developing a final comment letter. So the considerations around what service is the regulatory return compensating for, and whether there should actually be a broader notion of goods or services supplied, so that the model principle actually also encompasses situations where the regulatory returns are compensating for something else during the construction phase. There's a question of the representation of information that would be most relevant for users. I think that comment was captured by Linda's feedback in terms of what's the actual economics of the regulatory agreement and the returns being granted during construction. There's also been a question around the economic meaning of the recognized regulatory liability during construction. There's been a question of the impact of accounting requirements on regulatory agreements and on the incentives to complete projects. We've also endeavored to get a better sense of the operational concerns, including instances where construction work in progress is embedded within the regulatory asset base. I'd say that on balance, most views we've had so far during the outreach have tended to be against the ED's proposed treatment of regulatory returns for the construction work in progress. But there's also been some support for the ED proposals, including by a regulator who viewed that the approach could incentivize the timely completion of projects. Finally, I would note that our June CFSS session highlighted mixed views by jurisdictional representatives on the proposed CWIP treatment. Thank you.
Thank you, Vincent. Then finally, Takeshi.
Yes. Regarding question four, one member agrees with the focus on total allowed compensation. Regarding question five, two members disagree with the proposed exception to regulatory returns relating to assets under construction. They think that applying the general principle is appropriate. One member points out that there could be cases where it may not be possible to assess whether a performance incentive exists before preparing the financial statement. In this case, this member proposes that the ED should clarify that the performance incentive should be recognized in the period in which the performance incentive is known as a change in accounting estimate. Regarding question six, one member thinks that additional guidance or examples would be useful. For example, the effect of differences between balances under the IFRS standard and the corresponding regulatory basis. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Takeshi. Okay, please, Mariela, continue.
Yeah, thank you, Hans. So we'll continue now with measurement then. So the exposure draft proposes to measure regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities using a cash flow-based measurement technique that includes an estimate of all future cash flows arising from a regulatory asset or regulatory liability and discounts those estimated future cash flows to their present value. So a few features of the measurement proposals that are worth highlighting are the following. So when cash flows are uncertain, an entity would estimate them using either the most likely amount method or the expected value method, depending on which method the entity concludes would better predict those cash flows. An entity would need to update its estimates of future cash flows if changes occur. An entity would use the regulatory interest rate as the discount rate for all regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities, except in one circumstance that we'll cover in the next slide. And finally, the discount rate established at initial recognition would be kept unchanged unless the regulatory agreement changes the regulatory interest rate. So moving to the minimum interest rate test, regulatory agreements provide or charge compensation for the time lag between origination and recovery or fulfillment of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. We learned that regulatory agreements consider the duration of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities when establishing the interest rates and typically apply the same interest rate to all regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities within the same time band. Therefore, the rate applied to the time band does not necessarily capture exactly the characteristics of the cash flows, but is instead a blended rate for the whole time band. However, the board expected that in most cases, the regulatory interest rate would be sufficient to provide at least compensation or charge for time value of money and uncertainty in the cash flows. Consequently, the board concluded that from a benefit cost consideration, using the regulatory interest rate as a discount rate would be appropriate, would lead to the recognition of regulatory interest income or regulatory interest expense over time, and would lead to useful information to users. If the board had proposed to require entities to determine the exact rate that would reflect the features of the underlying cash flows, that would have implied first adding a complexity to the model, and second, it would have led to day one gains or losses, and the board did not think those day one gains or losses would always result in useful information for users. There is only one instance the board considered that day one gains or losses arising from using a rate different from the regulatory interest rate could result in useful information. And this is when the regulatory interest rate received for a regulatory asset is not providing an entity with sufficient compensation for time value of money and uncertainty in the cash flows. If that's the case, the AD proposes an entity to use the minimum interest rate that would compensate an entity sufficiently for time value of money and uncertainty. And the use of that minimum interest rate would lead, as a result, to a lower carrying amount for that asset. And that lower carrying amount has a meaning, and it is that, in effect, the regulator is disallowing part of the related allowable expenses. We are being asked quite often why this test was not proposed for regulatory liabilities. We just mentioned that regulatory agreements do not provide or charge a regulatory interest rates that exactly reflect the features of the cash flows. And therefore, then any difference between that theoretically exact rate and the regulatory interest rate for regulatory liabilities would in most cases not be due to a specific event that would justify the day one gain or loss. And as a result, then recognition of regulatory interest expense over time was considered to be appropriate in most cases. So again, for benefit cost considerations, the board proposed to use the regulatory interest rate for regulatory liabilities and recognize then regulatory interest expense over time in all circumstances. In the case of the regulatory assets, when using the minimum interest rate for discounting, that day one loss has a meaning, which is that in effect then the regulator is disallowing part of the related allowable expenses. That leads us to the questions that we have in the measurements section for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mariela. I open the floor. Vincent?
Yes, thank you, Hans. So with regard to question 7, we support the proposed cash flow-based measurement technique, and we think that this measurement technique is quite consistent with the measurement basis that you retain for regulatory assets and liabilities. That being said, we can see the technical merits of this approach, but we should not understate the fact that it will create some practical challenge because this is something new. It's sometimes pretty straightforward to precisely identify when the timing difference will reverse over time, but in some other circumstances that might prove to be quite more challenging. And this will require entities to design forecast processes just to measure the assets and liabilities. So we agree with the measurement basis, but we would like to outline the fact that this would create some practical challenge, that there would be some measurement uncertainty around, and that might slightly increase, that will increase the implementation cost of your proposal. And in that respect, we think that the statement that you have in paragraph 247 of the basis for conclusion on DD by saying that you expect no significant cost of applying the proposal, I think that this statement should slightly be watered down, in particular with regard to the implementation implications that the measurement technique will have. And this is also why we have a small minority of stakeholders in France were rather supportive of a cost deferral approach because they think that it's easier to defer the expense and wait and see what will happen and when it is charged to the customers.
And so that's why some have sympathy for the cost deferral approach, but and because of the implementation costs that are related to the cash flow based measurement technique. But that being said, INC, we expect to be supportive of your proposal. With regard to question 8, I don't have any comment on question 8, more on question 9 and 10. So I think that the first comment that I would like to make, and I think that was pretty clear when we discussed that with our working group and also at European level, is that at the moment, on the basis of what you have in DED, there is quite uncertainty about how to understand the purpose of discounting in this EV. So I think that the clarification that you brought, in particular when we had discussion at EFRAG level, were pretty helpful just to understand the objective of discounting. But I think that at the moment it's far from being clear that the objective of discounting is to reflect at minimum the time value of money plus the uncertainty, the cost of bearing uncertainty in the amount and timing of future cash flows. And I think that would help a lot if this objective could clearly be set out in DED, and also that some bits in the appendix to DED could be amended just to make the definition of regulatory interest rate consistent with that objective. And I think that bringing clarity about the purpose of discounting would also help stakeholders to understand why you introduced that minimum interest rate. So you provided some clarification in this respect, and I think that they are much welcome, but they are not really straightforward when you read the basis for conclusion on DED. And so that's why at the moment there is not much support for that minimum interest rate. I think that what would help, maybe bringing some support, is maybe to clearly state that the board wanted to specify a rebuttable presumption. In other words, that basically you apply the regulatory interest rate unless you have some evidence that this rate does not fulfill the discounting objective. And I think that would help assuage some concerns about this minimum interest rate, because people are reading the requirement at the moment as they will always have to assess whether the regulatory rate it provides sufficient compensation, and accordingly there are questions about how to determine that rate, uncertainties about the judgment involved, the auditability issue. So I think that we would encourage you to clearly specify that it is a rebuttable presumption here. And also why there is not much support for that minimum interest rate, because many of our stakeholders who will apply the board proposal are subject to, I would say, some public scrutiny. Basically, there is a negotiation process between the entity and the regulator, but this is usually a public negotiation process. And all the data and parameters that are used to set that rate are made public and available. So basically, in many circumstances, there is a presumption that the rate that would be granted by the regulator is a fair rate. And there is no other question to have in this respect, considering also the fact that basically the purpose in the context of defined rate regulation, the purpose of the regulator is to give the entity a rate that is sufficient that will help the entity to be financially viable. So that's why there is some misunderstanding about what you intended to capture. And I think that if you decide to proceed with this proposal in the final standards, I think that would be very helpful if you could provide clarity about the rebuttable presumption, the objective of discounting, and also the asymmetry that you have at the moment in the requirements about why applying that minimum interest rate for assets and accordingly recognizing day one losses, and not doing the same for regulatory liabilities, and accordingly not recognizing the day one gains. I think that the basis for conclusion in that respect are not sufficiently clear in this respect at the moment, and I think that would be very helpful if you could provide us more clarity on that. Thank you.
Sorry, yes, thank you, Vincent. Linda?
Thank you very much. I did lose connection there for a moment. We had an internet interruption, so I will try not to be repetitive, but I only have brief comments. We are generally supportive of the measurement proposals. We don't have any specific concerns that have been highlighted based on the outreach we've done thus far. We do have some suggestions that we think will be helpful to ease application or further clarify. So for instance, we're probably going to make some comments in our comment letter on the boundary of the regulatory agreement that we think will make things simpler for people and not cause them to do too much work. As well, the ED provides guidance on indicators for determining whether the regulatory interest rate is insufficient, but no guidance in determining what is the minimum interest rate. So it's likely that we will make some comments in that regard to reduce debate that could arise in practice and give some assistance to assist entities in this regard. Those are the only two things so far that we've noted, but otherwise we're very supportive. Thanks.
Thank you, Linda. Nobu?
Yes, thank you, Hans. Our preliminary view is that we are not convinced with using this regulatory interest rate. We think that requirements related to discount rates should be consistent with existing IFRS standards such as IS 36 or IS 37. In addition, we propose that there be a short-term exemption, meaning that entities should be permitted not to discount if the regulatory asset or liability is to be settled within 1 year. Thank you.
Thank you, Nobu. Jeho.
Thank you, Hans. I was going to make comments in the same way as Nobu said. So actually, we wonder whether the present value measurement model should be applied to every situation. For example, as Nobu mentioned, there might be a case in which a difference in timing spans only less than 1 year. So in such cases, strictly applying the present value measurement model might be very costly relative to the information benefit. So for such situations, we think a practical expedient could be contemplated, so that they are exempted from the present value measurement model. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeho Yu.
Okay, thank you, Hans. Two comments from the stakeholders. First one is regarding the cost-benefit principle. Some stakeholders in China expressed concerns that the ED might not be in line with the cost-benefit principle. From the perspective of the preparers, they think the preparation of the financial statement, the cost of preparation in practice will be very high, especially when estimating uncertain future cash flow, and they think it will be very difficult to use the regulatory interest rate to discount the estimated future cash flow in practice because there might be no regulatory interest rates in some regulatory agreement. In addition, from the view of the investors in our outreach, some investors also question the usefulness of the financial information. They think the usefulness of the financial information will be limited. They don't think there is urgent need for this kind of information. That's the first point. The second one is regarding the earnings management. Some stakeholder expressed some concerns that the application of the ED might create some opportunities for earnings management. Because this stakeholders think that there are different types of regulatory models and regulatory rates making mechanisms in different jurisdictions. The use of the most likely amount or expected value method proposed in the ED used to estimate the future cash flow will bring high uncertainties. That's the reason for their concerns. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, you. Vincent?
IFRAG's draft comment letter supported the discounting of regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. I would say links to Vincent Louise's comment on the objective, on clarity on the objective of discounting. IFRAG's draft comment letter did not express a view on which discount rate is appropriate. So we support discounting, but there's a question of which discount rate should be applied. So there are two views expressed in our draft comment letter. The first view was suggesting that there should be the use exclusively of the regulatory interest rates for the regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities. It is the negotiated rate. And as was pointed out, there's an element of objectivity associated with that rate, for instance, due to the public scrutiny that's involved when it's being determined. There are also concerns expressed about the operationality that's associated with actually getting to a minimum rate. View two was to use the general discounting principles applied in other IFRS standards, as expressed, I believe, by Nobu. So there was the view that in cases a significant financing component and the regulatory rate differs from the market rate, an entity should apply IFRS 15 requirements and use the prevailing interest rates in the relevant market. The feedback we've had so far in our outreach, as well as from the CFSS, has also aired mixed views on the appropriate discount rate. There have been views affirming the operational concerns of applying a minimum rate, but there's also some support for an approach that is similar to the ED's proposal. I think based on the idea that Vincent Louise also mentioned, there being a rebuttable presumption that the regulatory interest rate is the appropriate rate. Besides the question of discounting, at the June CFSS meeting, some members raised several questions where there may be need for clarification, and this revolved around recognition and measurement uncertainty. There was a question on whether the requirements for variable regulatory income are consistent with IFRS 15 requirements for the recognition of variable consideration. Some standard setters have also pointed that difficulties in measurement could arise as entities might still be negotiating with the regulator and do not be certain of how much they'd be entitled to recover or obliged to settle in future periods. So there are certain questions associated with the reliability and measurement uncertainty that would be in place when determining our regulatory assets and liabilities. Those are the comments I heard. Thank you.
Thank you, Vincent. Takeshi?
Thank you, Hans. Regarding question seven, one member supports the measurement approaches proposed in the ED, but suggests that ISP should take into consideration a situation where the estimations under regulatory agreements may extend some years into the future. Another member proposes that the ED should provide additional guidance on measurement, especially on demand risk and the boundary of the regulatory agreement. Regarding question eight, one member notes that the IFRS 15 provides constraining limitation, that is, it is highly probable that a significant reversal will not occur. This member suggests that the ISP should assess further whether this constraining limitation is also necessary in this ED. Regarding question nine, one member agrees with this proposal. Regarding question 10, one member notes that it could be difficult for an entity to determine a suitable interest rate other than the regulatory interest rate specified in the regulatory agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, Takeshi. And finally, Rodrigo.
Thank you, Rans. We agree with the proposed. However, we strongly recommend that the company issuing notes and all assumptions used to estimate the uncertain future cash flows. it's a very important point for us. About the discount rate, we believe that you should discount all cash flows using a single discount rate, regardless of the standards. I mean, it's a match technique, and you expect a consistency in application. One discount rate to rate regulator, or one rate for each agreement, it's not make sense for us. It's not what we expect. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Rodrigo. Then we go to the final question, Mariella. We are running a little bit over time, I'm afraid, so I would ask everybody to be as concise as possible. Mariella.
Yeah, thank you, Hans. So the idea does not specify a particular form of regulatory agreement. We are dealing now with IFRIC 12, sorry. So the EED does not specify a particular form of regulatory agreement. One of these forms might be a service concession arrangement, and service concession arrangements are subject to some form of rate regulation because the grantor regulates the price to be charged for the services. IFRIC 12 includes two models for accounting for rights and obligations arising from a service concession arrangement, the intangible asset model and the financial asset model. I'm ignoring for the moment now the hybrid model. And we think that some concession arrangements using the intangible model might create regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities within the scope of the exposure draft, but this will depend on the terms and other facts and circumstances. We initially, and I highlight initially, so don't think, however, that concession arrangements using the financial asset model may create regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities, because any rights that could give a right to future cash flows are already recognized as part of the financial asset. We have not had much input on the interaction between the proposals and IFRIC 12 so far. And hence our question for your input in slide 22, and probably to follow up this separately from this meeting, if you do have any examples on IFRIC 12 and how those concession arrangements might interact with the proposals, we'd be very interested in understanding and in having a look to those examples. So the question in slide 22 is whether you think some service concession arrangements in your jurisdiction might create regulatory assets or regulatory liabilities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mariella. Raymond?
Thank you, Hans. We certainly think that there are some industries that are going to be affected by this, but I think for us, understanding the scope is going to be key to this, because when we look at some of the sectors that are that we think may be affected, there are rail operators, there are roads, toll road operators, which we would think may potentially be scoped into this. But again, going back to the initial question, what's in the scope of this particular standard when it eventually comes out, that's going to be a key determinant, I guess, as to who should be accounting for this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Vincent?
Yes, thank you. So two quick comments about the fact that there were some concern when DD was published about other board proposals who would interact with IFRIC 12. Well, at the moment, it's quite also difficult for us to get some practical example and just to understand whether the interaction is nicely working. Having said that, we haven't been made aware of any potential negative interaction between the board proposal and IFRIC 12. So at the moment, I don't have anything else to add in that respect, not having heard negative feedback in this respect. Just a clarification maybe about what you said and maybe what is written in the snapshot on the ED. We think that basically you can have regulatory assets and liabilities applying both intangible and the financial asset model. Basically, we agree that with regard to the construction or upgrade services, basically you would have regulatory assets and liabilities only when you have the intangible asset, because if you have the financial asset, this means that you have an unconditional right to compensation. Having said that, under both models, on the operation service phase, well, basically in that case, you can have a rate adjustment mechanism, and accordingly, you could have regulatory assets and liabilities. So that's why it's slightly. So that's why that at minimum, on the construction, on the operation service phase, the model, the proposal could apply, and it's not only in one model.
Thank you, Vincent. Vincent?
I'd echo the comments as well and note that we are also seeking specific fact patterns that are IFRIC 12 related in both our outreach and ongoing effects analysis. The main comment I would make besides IFRIC 12 on the interaction with the other IFRS standards would relate to the IFRS 3 exception for acquired regulatory assets and assumed regulatory liabilities. So in that respect, we did not actually express a clear view on whether or not we did not have a position on that particular exception. So there are concerns we do have about exceptions in a general sense, and we are seeking stakeholder views on whether fair value measurement using an adjusted discount rate akin to the approach that's applied for the remeasurement of loans that are acquired at fair value within IFRS 9 requirements could be an approach that could be considered. At the same time, in our draft comment letter, we noted that the basis of conclusion had arguments justifying the exception. So we do seek stakeholder feedback on that particular exception. I would note that at the CFSS meeting, there are mixed views around the exception, but within our broader outreach, we've not had any concerns about the ISB proposed approach, but it's one where we actually have questions in order to formulate our final view in our comment letter. Thank you.
Thank you, Vincent. So, Mariella, you received a lot of rich feedback from our ASF members. Is there anything that you would like to recapitulate at the end of this meeting?
Not necessarily something specific. I think this feedback received is broadly aligned to what we have been receiving in all of the outreach events we have had so far. So we have already, we are ending the fifth comment period, month of the comment period. So we have been hearing many of these comments before. What I would only like to highlight is that I echo the comments on you still looking for examples on the scope. We are still looking for those, and also on IFRIC 12. So I think it is just to reinforce cooperation between ourselves and the network of national standard setters in these two regards, even beyond the comment period, I think, because we will need to keep up working on these two topics beyond the coming period. And I noted down a few items that are probably the best thing is to follow them up separately with the individual ASAF members. So nothing else from our side, only thank you very much for all this feedback.
Okay, thank you very much, Mariella. Then I suggest we take a 15 minutes break before we continue with goodwill and impairment.